I start my work with ideas. So I usually start with a theme, and I have multiple metaphysical questions that I want to answer, and then I create the planet afterward.
Coming up on In Contrast, Min Jin Lee. Amilan Stavans and In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions. Min Jin Lee was born in Seoul, South Korea, and as a child immigrated to New York with her parents. She is the author of fiction, nonfiction, reviews and essays, and two novels, Free Food for Millionaires and Pachinko. Pachinko was a National Book Award finalist and appeared on many critics' lists of the best books of 2017. Min Jin Lee, thank you for coming to In Contrast. I want to start with a question about belonging and connections. You were born in Seoul, in South Korea, and came to the United States at the age of seven and a half, and lived here and went to college. You had your schooling in the United States. Where is your heart? How is your heart divided? What is the sense of belonging that you have in connection with these two countries?
Oh, that's such a good question. Ilan, first of all, thank you for having me here. And I think my heart belongs in Queens. Isn't that weird? But it is. So I have spent most of my life writing about Koreans, but I write about Koreans in diaspora. So I have met Koreans all over the planet, and I really like them. They amuse me, and they engage me, so I really like that. However, I think that when I really think about myself, I think of myself as somebody who's an immigrant in Queens. And Queens probably has the most diverse immigrant population in America. So there's a lot of newcomers. So if you become successful, you move out of Queens very often. But somehow I feel very connected to those people.
Do you feel that all immigrants are alike? Is there a difference between immigrants arriving to Queens, for instance, in regards to the place they come from, the social class, the education? What is the difference between immigrants to Queens? Maybe immigrants from Korea to Queens.
I think immigrants to Queens are very fortunate. I think you can be an immigrant and go somewhere else in America and have a very hostile response. I felt really fortunate to live in Elmhurst, Queens, because we were very early. It was 1976, so there were hardly any Koreans there. And I was very awkward as a child, and I didn't speak until almost high school. It took me a really long time to understand how to speak and listen. I could speak, but I chose not to, and to the great consternation of most of the people around me because I was so off. And I don't know what that was. However, I had a lot of adults in my life from Queens who were so kind to me, who really kind of carried me through. And I know that's not the experience of most Koreans in America elsewhere. So I think because Queens has this kind of acceptance and kind of expectation of new arrivals, I was very fortunate. But I've had friends from who are Korean who lived in, let's say, Texas or in New Mexico or in Iowa, and they had things thrown at them. So I think that my experience was very fortunate.
And why did your parents go to Queens in particular? Were there already relatives there waiting?
So I'm a chain migration person. So my uncle John, he came to America a little bit after the war, and he was trying to become a grad student in Missouri. So he got some sort of fellowship. And then he was going to be a writer and a journalist. So he studied history. However, he couldn't continue his studies. It was too expensive. And also Missouri at that time, there's like this huge color divide. He wasn't white, he wasn't black, and he had no community, and he was the only one. So he moved to New York City, and he went to the New York Public Library, and he took out all these newspapers, all the classifieds, and tried to figure out what kind of job would make him some money. And he noticed that computer programmers at that time, in the late 50s, made money, and he's like, oh, I think I'm going to learn how to do it. And he's a humanities person. He took out all these books, and he read them, and he got hired by IBM. He had a little house in Queens, and he invited my mother. But my father is the one who wanted to come to America, not my mother.
And they came to America because of what? Was it the economic reasons? Was it the desire to reconnect with the family? What was the engine that pushed them out of Korea and into Queens?
Well, that's really curious because it wasn't those things. My parents weren't economic migrants. And when I look back, I think it's kind of odd. Because my father's a war refugee from the North. So when he was growing up, there was no North and South. He was just from Korea. But he was 16, and he came down for a few days thinking that he can avoid being conscripted by the Communist Army. And then it turned out, of course, he couldn't go back. So he ended up living in South Korea. My mother is from Busan, which is the south. And she grew up in a very stable household in Busan because her father was a minister and a headmaster of a school for orphans. So eventually they met in Seoul, they got married, and then my father always felt the sense that there'd be war again, and he didn't want to lose his family. So he was a very low-level marketing executive at a cosmetics company, and my mother was a piano teacher. They're very funny now because they really love each other now, but I think that in many ways they're very oddly matched. My father is not the kind of person who wants to work for somebody else. So he was always quitting jobs in Korea. And I don't know if that's individual, cultural, or his regional background. I'm not quite sure. Also, he was the sort of the spoiled son of a very wealthy family. And then he came down and became a war refugee. So he had this experience of class dislocation repeatedly. So every time he would quit his job, my mother would freak out because she had to support three children. So that's what we had. And then I think she wanted to make him calm. So in a way, coming to America was a kind of consolation and a concession to him.
I want to go back to that very first question that I asked you, Min. You said that you were not Korean, necessarily not American, but from Queens. If I can push you, do you feel gratitude to the United States for the way it opened its arms to the family? And do you still feel some debt in an umbilical cord to the Korea that your parents left behind?
I feel this enormous sense of debt to America. I do. However, I've spent most of my professional life in service to Koreans around the world, which is a very strange thing. But I do feel that they are very undefended and very misrepresented. So I've spent a lot of time doing it. However, I do think the burden representation becomes lighter as I get older because I'm so amused by what happens to the world. Whereas when I was younger, I did feel this sort of pressure like, oh, how do I say this in the right way? I was a student activist in college trying to get Korean taught at Yale University. And when I was 20, I raised $1 million with my friends to get Korean taught at Yale. And I can't believe that I did that now. It just seems sort of ridiculous to me. But of course, like all you need is 100 letters, but only one donor who kind of wants to come in. And that's what sort of happened. It was an accident. It wasn't because we were so clever. We might as well have had a cookie or a lemonade stand. So I think there's a part of me that really felt like the people that I come from are very interesting to me. Why does nobody know about them? So I do want to share that. And I think that's kind of unusual for my peer group.
What is the difference between Korean, particularly a South Korean in South Korea, and a South Korean in the diaspora in terms of demeanor? Does the way one relates to the world change as a result of living outside? And if so, how?
That's a really excellent, genius question. And I'm going to tell you why, because that's what I study. And I am so optimistic and hopeful in a way because of America, and also because of Queens. Because I've met so many Koreans elsewhere, they're like, no, I hate this country. I'm like, wow, that's amazing. Whereas I feel like, oh, how can I serve public libraries? Because I'm so indebted to librarians. And then, of course, South Koreans and South Korea today are, in many ways, very unhappy. They're very, very unhappy with a lot of things. At the same time, they do feel the sense of they have to represent and be proud. And the more I interview South Koreans in South Korea, the more I realize, oh, we have this sort of ethnic thing. We have this language. We also have the same narratives and culture and, of course, this very tragic history for the past 100 years. However, I feel like things can get better in a way that they, right now, South Koreans who are very young call Korea Hell Joseon. They call it hell because they feel like the class system won't change. And they call it the spoon system. So if you're born with a golden spoon, you get access to everything. But if you have a dirt spoon, you'll never get out. And of course, me being a history person, I think, well, the long view, that doesn't hold up because it used to be so much worse. But I think that because the economy has grown so rapidly, so quickly in South Korea, that the young people want the expectation of this great life, this kind of social media contrived existence. And I think they're very angry. And I connect with that. I understand why they say these things, but I'm surprised.
Do you think that that unhappiness you were describing that is intrinsic to South Koreans can disappear should conditions change, should social and economic structure be different? Or is it intrinsic to the way Koreans relate to the world?
Oh, well, I'm very curious about the speed of economic development and how it goes in parallel with the speed of how do you overcome the history of oppression. So if one outpaces the other, how do we process our grief? Also, is your grief allowed? Because very often Koreans will say, we can't talk about that. This also happens in Vietnam. So when you have rapid economic development, and then you also have, how do we deal with the fact that we were humiliated for 100 years? That the fact that the country was divided by somebody else, and we still have to deal with it. So I have great compassion for Koreans in the diaspora because they were scattered, and they wonder in the diaspora, was it punishment or was it intentional? And I'm not quite sure how much time people think about it or allow themselves narrative as to explain why. And I think if you don't have the narrative, you feel like you're purposeless.
Do you know how many Koreans live outside Korea? And to what extent are the Koreans outside exerting any influence on the way Koreans inside live their lives?
In America, there are, I think, a little bit under 1.5 million Koreans. And of them, they are all from South Korea, ultimately, because there are only 30,000 known defectors from North Korea, and they mostly live in South Korea. But there are some defectors who live here. So the experience is really from the South, and it would be primarily, after the 1965 immigration laws. I think what's really interesting to me is just how much influence, almost like too much influence for Koreans outside of South Korea and how we get to represent South Korea. And I think in a way, it's a little unfair. But of course, as you know, English is the lingua franca of the world. And if you can control English, you can control the narrative. But I'm very suspicious of that idea because perhaps we're not the most enlightened about what's going on in this country. And of course, self-determination is terribly important.
Now that we're on the subject of English, you said your first few years in the United States were about silence. It
Yes.
took a while for you to find a voice and to become that voice. Can you walk me through that process of acquiring English? The tension between Korean and English when you had just arrived as an immigrant, in what way did one cede the space to the other?
My parents are very untraditional. So when we came to America, my father wanted us to speak English at home. So they would speak to us in English and in Korean, and we would respond in English. And I'm the middle of three girls. Both my sisters had no problems doing this, but I had great problems just speaking at all. And I felt a real awkwardness around other children. So I was constantly trying to understand what was going on. Of course, young girls, I really were a complete puzzle. And the whole hierarchy of how young girls relate to each other. Now that I'm older, I look at it and go, oh, it's just because they have a queen bee system and alphas, and you have to understand the hierarchy and you have to pay homage to the queen bee. I understand that now, but I understood it primarily by reading. So I read through the Queen's Public Library system because of all these librarians. And I read children's literature and I just started to go. So I don't really understand how I learned how to read in English. My parents are still confounded by this, but it gave me this access of understanding organizational structure and manners and how people should behave. And I think that's what fiction writers are constantly struggling with. It's how do you behave interpersonally? So I had this sort of master class in books, but of course I was, again, out of time. I was asynchronous to my behavior because I was so old-fashioned. So very often, even now, I always feel like I'm 50 years behind about how people should behave. That said, I also have more confidence because I took all these classes on learning how to talk, because I knew that in America, if you are Asian and female and you don't talk, people think you're either stupid or excessively compliant. And there's a part of me that didn't want that. I wanted to be able to listen, but also to express what I was thinking. So when I was in high school, I decided that I would join the debate team. And to go from being a quiet person to learning how to argue, oh my gosh, it was perhaps unwise.
And how did you learn to argue?
Badly, just totally fumbling, because I knew I had to do this thing. I had to do it because all the books, especially for the Western literature, because I was so deep in it, you had to be a spitfire. Like even all the female heroines in 19th century literature, they're all kind of train wrecks slash spitfires, right? So I thought, okay, I have to learn how to talk. I mean, this is what Jane Austen would want for me. And then I did it for a year and I thought, okay, I think I can argue. And I think I understand the nature of argument. That was very important. And then I took speech classes. So in the summertime, I asked my parents, could I go to these summer programs? Because I want to take public speaking. And I did. I took two very difficult public speaking classes and I learned how to tell a joke in front of other people. So now I can do it, but it was like the way someone could learn how to drive a car. It wasn't natural to me. It isn't natural to me.
What are the tools that you use to tell a joke in front of people now?
Well, a joke is a story. It's a very concise story with a beginning, middle, and an end. And there must be a payoff. In that way, it's not that different from episodic 19th century literature. Mm. There has to be a payoff at the end of a scene. And if you don't do it, you failed. So I think about that. But the greatest thing, if I could ever help anyone who had my weird problems, is that I learned that most people are really rooting for you. So whatever anxieties that you have about judgment and failure are actually statistically unsound. Most people in the audience, if they left their house and came to see you, it's because they want to have a good time and they want you to succeed. And they're not trying to find mistakes with the way you speak. And I think realizing that they're on my team has really helped me.
I have a friend who is Japanese. The other day, he told me that Americans talk much more than people in Japan and in Asia in general, that we in this country just fill the space with words, whereas in Asia, far less so. And I asked him why, and he said to me that it's because in America you have to get noticed. Do we talk too much here compared to Asia? How is the difference between the way we relate to language, language in general, doesn't have to be Korean, between the older generation of your parents that you're talking about and the frequency with which we utter words?
Well, I can speak for Japan and Korea. I can't really speak for other places because I've lived in both places as adults. So I think that in general, Japan speaks significantly less than South Korea. So I bet if you were an anthropologist or a sociologist and you counted words per minute, you'd probably would actually notice significantly less. As a matter of fact, when you're on the subway in Tokyo, it's like a library. It is so quiet. And if you were to say something, people would turn and look at you because it's understood as a social norm. You don't talk. Whereas if you're on the subway in Manhattan, as you know, it's a disco. I found that silence to be really hard when I was living in Japan. I lived there for 4 years, and I missed the colloquial banter that you have with strangers. I realize how much I rely on chatting with strangers. Even if I'm not a chatty person, unless I think I should be a chatty person. So someone recently said to me, oh, you do these things all the time. You can't possibly not be able to speak. And I said to her, well, I think I'm a very polite person. And I would not want another person to feel uncomfortable by not speaking. And that's the interesting thing about words. Are you withholding or are you giving? Because you could use language to make another person feel rejected. So there are different kinds of silences. And I think in Asia, there's a kind of silence in which it could be silent and welcoming. And in America, silence is often interpreted as rejection. So I think about that. That said, do I think Americans talk too much? I'm going to say regionally, it's different, right? So the Northeast, the South, the Midwest, they're all different. What I think is really interesting is when you're on an airplane and you'll have a certain kind of man and he will speak very loudly. So what he says, not even remotely interesting. However, he's controlling the narrative of the entire plane. And I kind of think, wow, what kind of entitlement gives you that power to speak in that volume? And I'm not quite sure if it's because he's hard of hearing. I mean, that could be it, right? If you're a sensitive person, maybe that's what it is. But very often, this discussion that's not relevant becomes something that everybody has to sort of suffer through.
Whereas for a woman to speak loudly, the connotations are very different.
It's terrible. So if you are a woman in America or elsewhere and you talk too much or too loudly or say things that are out of turn, people will say very quickly that you are not acceptable in society. I always think I'm allowed to speak if people ask me a question, or I would really prefer to ask questions. So I really like interviews, and all of my fiction requires interviewing. So I do all these interviews all the time because I do want to know people, but I don't feel allowed to ask unless there's a mission. But generally, I'm really curious about everybody. But I can't interview everybody. But now I kind of can. Mm. I can actually kind of go, well, I'm working on a book about education. Can I talk to you? What's your experience as a parent? And then I can have this time.
You said a few minutes ago that you don't see yourself as chatty. Is the chatty Min that I have in front of me not the one that is outside the studio?
Oh, I'm totally different. I really like quiet. I will say, in my defense, I'm being really quiet.
I wasn't attacking you.
No, but I'm trying to understand it because in America, if you are quiet, it's weird. It's really, really weird. And as a matter of fact, people are very suspicious of those who are quiet. But I have a really rich interior life and I like it. I like my life. And also, I really like books. I feel really comfortable. Mm.
I find it fascinating. Of course, one of your books, Pachinko, is about the connection or the disconnections between Korea and Japan. And you are married to a man who is part Japanese. Given the history of colonialism of Japan and Korea, without entering, obviously, into personal aspects that are none of my business, in what way the history forces play out in the relationship that you have had with him or with other people that are Japanese? Do you forget the traumatic incidents that have happened and you see the people for what they are? Or do you, I'm thinking, I myself, Jewish, and having been in Germany, it took a while to go beyond certain stereotypes of the Nazi past in order to appreciate people for what they are. Does this happen to you?
It happens to me a lot. I think about it because we're reminded of it. Unfortunately, most people have not recovered emotionally and intellectually. And I don't mean the people who were oppressed or eliminated. I'm talking about the people who did those things. They were actually the fastest to smooth over what they did. And I think that's interesting. So because they do this, they're trying to be like, oh, let's move on. Because of this let's move on idea that has happened in the past 50, 60, 70 years, 80 years, what ends up happening to the people who have been a member or the descendants of that tribe, there's a lot of bizarre interactions that happen. And I also think that the unconscious often produces very strange commentary. So when I married my husband, I was engaged at 23. So I met him at 22. So we got married. I was 24. He was 27. He was half Japanese. His mother is from a very ruling class family in Japan. So I think his great grandfather was even the governor general of Taiwan when they colonized Taiwan. Mm-hmm. So if you go there, you can actually see his name on this corner. And then my father-in-law, who's alive right now, my mother-in-law passed away. He is from Iowa, and he is an Irish-American, but mostly German-French. So he's one of these, you know, white Americans with an Irish last name, but he's probably 10% Irish. So when we met, I wasn't thinking about it because I was so young. And so I knew some of the history, but I didn't know hardly any of it. But then when we got married, when I lived in Japan, actually, I should say, when I visited initially and I met his entire Japanese family, it was very awkward because it was a bit like, guess who's here for dinner? Because I was this big Korean. Like, what is she doing here? And they have our precious darling Christopher. And they were very ruling class gracious. Sometimes when you find ruling class people, they have a kind of elegant condescension that you could not understand. So I wanted them to like me because I had married their son. And they were mostly pleasant. But it would come up in these very strange ways. I was really nervous, and they didn't tell me that they were throwing a very fancy party for us in Tokyo. So we go to this place, and of course, things were named after their family because it was a very fancy room. And I grew up working class, mostly in Queens, so all of it was kind of splendor. So we go to this room, and they said, oh, say something to everybody. Again, I didn't know that I was going to give a speech. And at one point, I kind of said, oh, I was told that the Japanese don't like the Koreans, but you guys have been so gracious. Now, 49-year-old Minjin would not have said that. But 24-year-old Minjin, who was a new bride, didn't know I was going to talk, said something stupid. And again, my subconscious gave this ridiculous opening. And I remember everybody just looked down and they were so upset. And later on, my mother-in-law chided me and said, how could you say that? How could you be so ungrateful? And now I can say, if I looked back at her, I would have just said, you're an idiot. You should have just told me what was going to happen, because of course we'd have this thing. Why did you have to make this excessive gesture of, see, we like Koreans. We like Koreans so much, we'll throw this fancy party for her. But I think part of that is the wisdom of getting older and also the understanding. So things like that would happen. And again, I guess I could handle it better now, but back then I would bristle at some of these events. And when I was living in Japan as an older person, I lived there between 2007 to 2011. Whenever bizarro things would happen where someone would say, oh, you're just saying that because you have angry Korean blood, the commentary like that, I would be able to deflect it eventually. But again, it would be shocking because I would forget for a second, like, oh, that's right, I'm Korean, but I didn't know I had angry Korean blood. But that's a common idea. That's a social norm of Japan. I think the most difficult thing that I am struggling with as I think about mortality and about who I want to be is recognizing that people who could be very, very good could also hold evil ideas and act on it. And the older I get, the more I realize this is true. And people who have beautiful, pristine ideas can behave very badly.
And this, of course, also affects you and me.
Absolutely. So the older I get, the more I think, how do I understand intention and behavior? And what do I judge?
I want to go to the novels, Free Food for Millionaires and Pachinko. There are 10 years in between them. One was published in 2007, the other one in 2017. Both of them are big novels, big 19th century novels written in the 21st century, multi-generational. Pachinko in particular maps an entire family tree from humble beginnings to success and status. It seems to me that you, and maybe the culture you come from, you are very aware of the position in which you are as an individual in that tree and how that tree functions organically, dynamically. It's fascinating, the individual freedom that each of the characters that you can have and the responsibility that there is to that family tree. Is that something that defines you as an individual too, very much, in the culture that you're coming from?
I do think that I am an individual and I am in context of my community. And I have multiple communities and I like them. I think that there's a kind of lie in Western literature of the individual who exists without community, especially in 20th and 21st century literature. And as a matter of fact, that makes it very unrelatable to the average reader. So when I meet readers all the time, they're always saying things like, yeah, I really like this idea, but that at the same time, I don't understand it. Because we can't really understand ourselves without understanding the people around us who shaped us, whether you like it or not. I mean, you could resist against it, but again, there's something to resist. So in Korea, naming is very important. So for example, if you are an aunt, you're not an aunt. You're an aunt in relationship to your brother or your sister. So if you are a niece or a nephew, you address that person depending upon their genealogical relationship with the father, brother, or father, sister. And all these things are constantly changing. And I think that for me, just because I'm female and because I grew up, especially in America, in a kind of working class background, I know exactly where I belong. And I don't like to overstep because the punishment will be fast and furious.
Such as?
I think social rejection, or worse than social rejection, is a kind of being corrected and saying, you're overstepping your boundaries, you don't belong here, or who do you think you are? I definitely feel that even today. So very often my attitude is, I'll take the lowest position and it's fine. What's the big deal? But that's just me. However, I've noticed that one of the problems that I have with the policymaking of the world is that very often when you have this underestimation of Asians, you make terrible policy decisions. Because now that I know so many Koreans around the planet, I realize that there are certain things in common. There's a kind of adaptiveness that's almost bizarrely useful, at the same time dangerous. And I think it's because their understanding of organization and organizational behavior is so strong. And it's because in Korea, it's so normal. And as a matter of fact, when I meet Americans who have no concept of organizational behavior, I kind of think, you're in trouble. You're in trouble because someone's going to knock you off your chair, and it's not going to be nice. But at the same time, if you think about it in terms of policy or international relations and foreign affairs, something I'm very interested in, I think that the misunderstanding of Asia and other countries is constantly causing Americans problems.
Does all this also get defined by the fact that you are a middle daughter? That is, not the oldest or the youngest one. Do you see the world as a middle daughter?
A middle daughter, and also compared to my sisters, I'm kind of intellectually slow. So both of my sisters are really super smart, and they have had success much faster in lots of ways, especially socially. So I grow up in a kind of wonder at their abilities. Like, my younger sister has this ability to get along with anybody. She's very funny. She's a very successful business person. She owns this really huge company. And my older sister has a kind of amazing leadership skills. Like, she can kind of marshal forces and deploy them. So whereas I was just kind of confused. I was confused for such a long time. I feel very confused mostly even now. And I'm not trying to be modest. It's just that we have such different skill sets. So I think that my older sister was very protective of me because I was bullied quite a lot as a kid. And then my younger sister just kind of took over with her own personality. For example, my younger sister was the president at Stuyvesant High School, a very elite high school in Manhattan that's public, for 4 years in a row. She was a student body president. I mean, that amazing idea that someone can get all those votes for 4 years in a row at Stuyvesant High School just sort of indicates what she can do when I could barely have a friend. Definitely, the positionality of my birth order definitely determines who I am. And I feel kind of safe because it isn't that I was unhappy with it, because I did have this company and I do feel their protection all the time. Even now, like, I think people have asked me, how has your book done so well? And I think, well, my sisters have told everybody.
The characters in Pachinko and in Free Food for Millionaires, in the journey that they have as immigrants or that they have from one country to another, they are in the quest of ascending in the social hierarchy and of acquiring status and power that comes with it. Status seems to be, I would say, a leitmotif in the two. Explore that for me.
I'm so interested in status and what it means and the obsession of status. And also, what do you do when you get it? So all the different emblems of status, whether it's beauty or money or position or accolades, all those things are constantly in operation and people don't talk about it. And of course, as a child, I thought, why is that person really rich? Like, why do they bow and scrape toward that person? Like, I wanted to understand it. And of course, coming from this country that was so interested in organization of a society, I wanted to understand what was going on. And now that, as a matter of fact, my first novel is taught at Columbia to a bunch of young kids who are often Asian Americans who take this class. It's a psychology of Asian American literature. So I meet all these kids all the time, and several of them have said to me, I read your book almost like a playbook of how to succeed. And I think that's interesting because my main character, without doing any spoilers, is very critical of success. But they're using it in another way. And I thought, wow, I was chronicling it because I was suspicious of it, but rather their attitude is, no, I'm going to try to use it to figure out how to apply to law school or how to work at an investment bank. And I thought, okay. But then, of course, that makes a lot of sense too, because it's all there.
Just as the Jews before, who were seen as the successful minority, the Asians,
underestimated successful minority.
Yes.
That's really important. The underestimation part is very important.
I, in fact, want you to go there. What is that criticism or the underestimation or the view that you can achieve, but then you're critical of the achievement and that you can achieve, but others will not acknowledge that the achievement was there?
Well, I think underestimation is so important to understanding people of color around the world. And I use the word people of color, but I really should use the word minorities. So if you are a statistical minority anywhere, and I just mean that as a sociologist kind of would speak, not as in some sort of insult. If you are a minority and you are underestimated, you have to decide, are they correct? Is the majority correct? Should I be underestimated? Mm-hmm. Or are they wrong? And I think that spirit of defiance depends upon your cultural context. And I think that with the Jews, as well as East Asians who come from a Confucian aspect and are highly literate people, and where exams and testing and dialogue are valued. So in that sense, it's mostly defiance we'll show them. So I've seen that a lot. However, there are members of that community who are kind of wondering, why? Why should I show them? Because essentially, ontologically, who am I that I have to prove this thing to the larger group? And that's interesting to me, too, because it isn't like all of us are just kind of sheep saying, yes, I'm going to get that target and they'll know. Because even if you get there, and also in all of my interviews, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You can hit those targets. And yet, you still will not be seen for who you really want to be seen.
But there's some beauty, isn't there, in not being seen for what you could be seen? Because if you were seen for what you have done, then is there a purpose to continue struggling?
Ah, is there a reward for underestimation?
In other words, is it good not to get a prize that you were nominated for? Because then there's a reason for you to write the next book that probably will get you that prize.
Yes, I have experienced loss very recently. You know, it's funny about the National Book Awards because I remember going. Well, I had never had that experience before. So I go there and I invited my parents. My parents came. My sisters came. Everybody came. And I was sitting there and I got all dressed up and I wore lipstick, all of it. And of course, they announce it at that moment. And I didn't know that because I'd never been there before. And of course, I had not anticipated what would happen either way. And I thought, oh, everybody's watching me lose. This is awesome. No, not awesome. And I remember thinking, oh, I lost the privacy of the loss. Whereas like if you get a story rejected by a quarterly or a magazine,
nobody finds out.
Nobody finds out until you tell them and complain. And it's very private. And that was so shocking, that loss of privacy. And I realized, and my cheeks burned because, of course, everybody's staring at you, especially my table was really concerned. Like, oh, is she going to start crying? We don't know. But will that fuel me to write the next book? That's a very individual question, because I think I've always been somebody who's very defiant. I've always felt the sense of, well, I'm going to do what I want to do anyway. And very often, I took the wrong bets. I've taken a lot of wrong bets. And I wasn't even sure if being a writer was a good bet. Just very recently, when my husband lost his job, and he has a job now, but he was out of work for 8.5 months, and we were trying to figure out the whole health insurance thing. I thought, oh, I made the wrong bet again. Like, I should have stayed being a lawyer. We would have had greater stability. And that was really dumb. And I remember at one point, my younger sister, the one who's very successful, said to me, you're an idiot. This is what you're supposed to be doing. You have to keep going. But I am plagued with doubt.
There are two traditions that converge in your novels. One is the tradition of the 19th century, big, epic, passion-driven novel, that Jane Eyre of Pride and Prejudice, Middlemarch, so on and so forth. And the other one is the tradition of the immigrant American odyssey that goes from the periphery or the margins to the center, that comes to terms with individuality, with the collectiveness, with society. Some of them, the Russian or the American novels of the 19th century or the British novels, tend to be, like your books, very hefty in terms of characters, in terms of in length. The immigrant tradition varies in length. It has the voice of the immigrant in one way or another. You shift narrators constantly in a very Faulknerian way. You're entering the minds of the characters. Even before sitting and writing the books, you're very conscious of these two traditions?
Oh, absolutely. I know a lot about Asian American literature, and I know a lot about immigrant literature. So I was thinking about you today, about Anzia Yezierska, you know, the bread givers. I remember reading that when I was in college, and I remember being really affected by it. But then I also thought, wow, what was it like to be her, to write this story at that moment? I guess she had difficulty with her father, about her being an artist. But that kind of story was not the kind of story I wanted to write. I thought, I'm really happy. It was almost a document of that time. I wasn't interested in writing a document of a certain time. I was interested in having a whole tableau of a world. And I start my work with ideas. So I usually start with a theme. And I have multiple metaphysical questions that I want to answer. And then I create the planet afterward. So I'm not a voice writer. I'm not an image writer. I don't start with, oh, I saw this person in a train and I wondered what happened. That's not me. So if it's not intellectually engaging to me, I don't want to write it. Also, I want to only write fiction, especially novels, with an omniscient narrator because I don't think I'm that interesting. I don't see that my main characters as avatars of me. I think they are concoctions of all these people that I interview, and I want to stay with them. And then I care a lot about my minor characters. They're fascinating to me, and I want to explore what happens to them and their conflicts. But I've been very influenced by people like Balzac and Zola, as well as the British and the Russians, and they created a world in which I felt truly immersed. And again, the dissatisfaction that I have with, I guess, contemporary society. This world is in many ways very unsatisfying. And I think it's because we're horrible in lots of ways. We do terrible things to each other.
We're coming to an end here, and I have two more questions. The first one is, it's a simple one. Do you like writing? Do you like sitting down and writing? Or is it painful to you, the very act of putting words on a screen or on a page?
Oh, I love writing. I love writing. I like revising. I don't like earning a living. That's really hard. It's really hard as a writer to do that. I don't like thinking about it. But I don't mind any of it. I like writing reviews. I do all different kinds of writing, and I enjoy it. I like putting sentences together. I prefer writing probably more than anything else.
And do you think that novels like the two that you have written and given us teach us readers how to live beyond the large and small characters, the sprawling plots across borders, across ages? Do you ultimately see a purpose of improving us in how we live?
Yes. Isn't that terrible? But yes, I believe in the moral novel. I believe in moral justice. I believe that the first sentences of all of my novels, all two of them, and my third one, which I already have the first sentence, are thesis statements of the way I think life is. The first sentence of Free Food for Millionaires is, competence can be a curse. So I am really critiquing what competence is.
In the first sentence of Pachinko is, history has failed us, but no matter.
Yes. And I am saying that the world is broken, and yet you have to resist. So I am saying those things. And that's when you will see me, the narrator, saying that, because I believe it. And if my reader likes that, great. But I am having a point of view. I'm not neutral. I'm absolutely not neutral. Like, I think there's meaning in life. I think there's a meaning in this moment. So that's weird.
Well, it's been extraordinary having you in the show. Thank you very much for coming.
Oh, thank you, Ilan.
Status is a mirage, a trap. Yet all of us are in an eternal race to attain it. Lao Tse writes, some people think they can find satisfaction in good food, fine clothes, lively music, and sexual pleasure. However, when they have all these things, they are not satisfied. They realize happiness is not simply having their material needs met. Thus, society has set up a system of rewards that go beyond material goods. These include titles, social recognition, status, and political power, all wrapped up in a package called self-fulfillment. Attracted by these prices and goaded on by social pressure, people spend their short lives tiring body and mind to chase after these goals. Perhaps this gives them the feeling that they have achieved something in their lives, but in reality, they have sacrificed a lot in life. They can no longer see, hear, act, feel, or think from their hearts. Everything they do is dictated by whether it can provide social gains. In the end, they've spent their lives following other people's demands and never lived a life of their own. How different is this from the life of a slave or a prisoner? Assimilation is the ticket to the American dream. That dream isn't only about a better life. That's what we often hear. Immigrants go out of their way so that their children will be better than them. It's true. Yet behind that betterment, there is status. climbing in the social ladder, the realization that you and your family are at the center of the world. It takes far more effort to see beyond that mirage, to realize that assimilation doesn't mean intellectual, spiritual, and emotional stagnation. At its core, the American dream can be hollow. It can be about money, sex, and power. It can be, and often is, about brands. Names are the monikers of status, and name-dropping is a way to show off the degree to which that status is an end. It is also a trap. The life of the body without a vigorous life of the mind isn't worth the effort. La Rochefoucauld said that the world more often rewards outward signs of merit than merit itself. Next time on In Contrast.
President Nasser of Egypt, Yasser Arafat of the PLO, Saddam Hussein of Iraq, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran, they all declared that they want to destroy the state of Israel and expel or kill the Jews. When you put all this on one table, you end up with the phrase that also consists the name of the book, comes from the Babylonian Talmud. When someone comes to kill you, rise up and kill him first.
The Secret History of Israel's Targeted Assassinations with Ronen Bergman on the next In Contrast. Let us know what you think about In Contrast. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series. Our interns are Delina Hadgu and Jacob Pagano. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.